Let's go through every single package installed with a Linux install image. I'm going through the software included with Slackware, but these are all open source applications and libraries, so whether you're running Slackware like me, or Fedora, Debian, BSD, or even Mac or Windows, you can probably download, install, and try these on your computer. So chances are, you'll be able to learn something from this podcast. Let's get started. We're going to start out with Pango, P-A-N-G-O. And you know what? Let's just take Pango MM at the same time, just to make this a little bit more efficient. I'm actually out of town right now. I live in Lawrence, a little town called Lawrence in New Zealand, and there's a nearby, let's call it a city. We'll just call it a city for the sake of argument, called Invercargill. It's a little bit south. And I'm visiting Invercargill for a variety of reasons. Never been there before. That's one of the reasons I want to visit it. There are a lot of places in New Zealand I have never been, even though I've been here now 10 years, if you can believe that. You may be able to believe that. I can't believe it, but I have been 10 years here. And you know, there are still places I've never seen, so why not? Just go see them all. So that's where I am right now. So in this episode, I'll get through the P's in the L section of the Slackware install, and then call it quits. I will end the podcast. No, I will call this episode quits. Just because I'm out of town. I don't have time to sit around and record all the way through the P's and the Q's. I got to stop at the P's. Okay, so Pango MM. Pango is the the text layout and rendering library, internationalized text layout and rendering library used by GTK. If you go to docs.gtk.org/pango, then you'll get all the documentation, including all of the different classes and the different functions and all these other things. This is a very low-level library. This is dealing with stuff that you just don't think about all that often. You're probably not going to use this directly. You're going to use it directly. A lot of times when you use this, it will be because GTK is using it anyway. So it's not necessarily something that you're going to really give that much thought about. Depending on what you're doing, though, you know, I mean, it does obviously depend. But there are classes like font. What font is going to get used here? So you might use that class, I guess. There's layout. How do you want the lines of text in your application to appear? And by that, I mean, like, how much space between the two lines of text do you want to have in your application? Well, I mean, obviously, that's the layout class within Pango. But there's a lot of other stuff. Like, there are functions to help you create a background color or change the font color, or, as I said, to set what font you want, or the font scale, the foreground color, and so on. If you think about the text bar in LibreOffice, then you can kind of imagine that, but the code version of that. This does all of that stuff, except you're just typing out the code. And in, for instance, CSS, where you're applying different styles to font based on tags or based on the class of the element that you want to modify. Again, kind of the same idea here. Now, as a hobbyist programmer, I look at this sort of thing and I just think, well, I'd rather do it in CSS, or I'd rather do it, some other way. And that's perfectly fine. Like, if that's you, that's perfectly fine as well. But somebody's got to make the easier ways happen. Like, CSS doesn't just happen on its own. Someone has to program the browser that then respects the CSS's wishes. This is the library for those people. Like, this is what they're using. Like, literally. Like, this is what Firefox uses. Pango is the library that lets me see the stuff in my web browser according to the way... Well, actually, you know what? I don't know that that's entirely true, because the web page rendering itself might be done through something else. But certainly the interface is using Pango, like the actual, you know, the application itself. So Pango MM, of course, is the same thing, except it's for C++. And then there's Parted. That's the next thing in this list. Now, Parted is kind of an interesting thing to have in this section, because like many other things, I think of this primarily as an application. And there is indeed an executable file in user sbin. There's Parted and Part Probe. So why is it in the lib section, the L section of Slackware? Well, there is a libparted-fs-resize.so, libparted.so in the /usr/lib64 directory. So there is a library for Parted, and I'm going to assume that the thing that uses that library is Parted itself. Let's see, ldd on user sbin parted only actually confirms that libparted is being used by libparted. I wonder if part probe is using the other library. No, I can't find what's using that other library, but that's fine. Parted is a great application. It is, for me, the superior partition manager or partitioner for a terminal. I mean, and I say for the terminal because, I mean, that is specifically what I like about Parted is that it, you know, if I have to do partition stuff in a terminal, which I don't love to do, to be honest, then I would want to use Parted rather than fdisk. Although, you know what, given sometimes, actually, I do actually don't mind cfdisk or cgdisk. But look, I mean, bottom line is I hate partitioning. That's a thing that I just don't like about hard drives. I would like it more, I guess, if I could just say, there's my hard drive, make it all this file system. Of course, except when I need more flexibility than that. And then I love partitioning. And that's the catch. That's always the catch with these sorts of things for me. It's like, oh, I don't want to be bothered. This is horrible. This is the most painful, stupidest, most manual thing ever in the world. Why is it so horrible? And then, of course, when I need it to be the most manual thing in the world, then it's brilliant. It's the most, this is the kind of thing that, you know, this is why I use computers, because of the precision that I can have over this hard drive. So it really is, it's a love and hate relationship, I guess, where it's a little bit of love and a little bit of hate just at alternating moments. Is that what love and hate is? I'm not really sure what a love and hate relationship is, but whatever it is, I have it with Parted, or I'd rather with partitioning disks, and Parted is a really good tool for doing it. And the reason it's such a good tool is because it can be non-interactive. It doesn't have to be. It can be interactive, but you have the choice of it not being interactive. So for instance, if you just type in Parted, nothing will happen because it's in sbin, and you probably don't, as a user, don't have that in your path. So I'm going to become root, and then I'm going to type in Parted, and nothing happens. Oh, there we go. Okay, wow, that took a weirdly long time. Is that a bad sign? Does that mean my hard drive is about to fail? I don't know. Hopefully not. I'll have to run smart cuddle on it soon. But when you launch Parted, if you just type in Parted, P-A-R-T-E-D, and then press return, then you are placed into an interactive Parted console, which is kind of nice, and it says, welcome to GNU Parted. Type help to view a list of commands, which is, like, honestly, one of the most helpful prompts I've ever gotten from a terminal application. It tells you exactly what to do next. It's like, press help, or type help. Of course, from then on, you're on your own, so it doesn't last. But there you go. There's the thing. It's interactive, and it gives you a list. Align, check, type in, help, make label, make table, make part, name, print, quit, rescue, it's promising, resize part, remove, dangerous, select device, and so on. There's a bunch of different options as you'd expect. Now, the important thing to note here is that because you just typed in Parted and hit return, hit enter, whatever, it defaults to your, as far as I know, actually, you know what? No, yeah, as far as I know, it defaults to your boot device. So in this case, that's dev SDA. And if that's not the device you want it to default to, then you need to be aware of that, because that could be, you know, bad if that wasn't the device that you wanted. No, that's not your boot device. Sorry. it's defaulting to the first drive in the device list, so dev SDA, because my boot device is actually dev NVMe0N1, which I should have known. I don't know why I didn't think of that. So dev SDA. So yeah, that's going to like the first drive in the list. That may or may not be the drive that you want it to be looking at. You need to be aware of that before, you know, removing a partition or repartitioning something. So you can avoid that by doing parted dev slash SD, you know, something else. Let's do SD. I'm looking for something I don't mind putting at risk. How about SDD? Okay, now it launches parted that interactive interface to dev SDD. So now that's the active drive within parted. But I don't really necessarily love the interactive interface. So I'm going to type in quit and leave that interface because that's not how I use parted. I prefer parted as a non-interactive. That's why I like parted, because you can do this and then walk away, or, you know, you probably don't have to walk away, but you could do this in a script, and that's really nice. So parted, let's do dev SDD space print. That's a save command. So all we're doing there is printing the partition layout of slash dev slash SDD, and it prints it out to my terminal. It tells me the model of the drive. It tells me the disk that I'm looking at, which is dev SDD. It's 320 gigabytes. Here's the sector size in logical and physical values. Partition table, the kind of partition table it is. This one happens to be an MS-DOS partition table because it's a, you know, like a traditional old style drive, not like a GUID partition. And then it prints out the actual partition layout. So there's partition 1 is 1049 kilobytes at the very front of the drive. That's the little boot partition. Partition 2 is probably the swap. Yeah, swap space. And then partition 3 is like a 319 gigabytes, ends at 320 gigabytes. So it's a 1 gig. So that's the swap space. Partition 2 is from 525 megabytes to 319 gigabytes, and that's the drive itself. And then at the very tail end, there's about a gig of swap space, probably because whatever I last had on this drive mandated a swap space, because I don't think I would have done that myself. Certainly not. It's only a gig. Anyway, point is, that's the layout. And if I wanted to repartition this, I could with parted. And the way I would do that, I guess, is do parted dash dash help first to get that list of commands, and then I would do something like parted slash dev slash SDD, and then we could do like a different partition. So we could also change the table type or the label, and that is, let's see what the options are there. Make label, we've got create a new disk label partition table of label type. Label type can be any one of AIX, Amiga, BSD, DVH, GPT, Loop, Mac, MS-DOS, PC98, or Sun. Well, in this case, I'm going to do GPT. Actually, you know what? I'm going to stop this process right now, and I'm just going to make sure I'm going to use a fake drive. I'm starting to scare myself with the possibility of writing over something that I don't intend to overwrite. So I'm plugging in a USB drive, which I've just confirmed comes up as SDG. And so now I'm going to do a parted slash dev slash SDG print. And that confirms that this little thumb drive has about, it's a 2 gig thumb drive, so it's ancient. It's got some data on there, but I do know that I don't care about that data. So I'm gonna use this as my test drive. So the thing to, again, remember about parted is, even when you're doing the command on, you know, non-interactively, the name of the drive, or the drive, the device location, dev SDG or whatever it is the first thing you enter. Parted, and then the thing, and then all the options come after it. I feel like that often feels wrong. You know, we're typically trained by our commands that it's the command and then a several sets of options and then the thing that you want to operate on. And for whatever reason in Parted, that just throws that out the window, and you it's Parted space device. I don't love that about Parted. I feel like repetition is the key to mastery, and I just don't like it when commands decide to invent their own new rules, especially when that command is something that is potentially catastrophic. I mean, this could ruin your drive. But having been said, I've never had Parted ruin a drive because I've forgotten to put the drive name in first. In fact, quite the contrary. Very frequently, all the time, it errors out if I forget the drive name because it can't find the drive called, print. So Parted space print space dev SDG could not stat device print. No such file or directory. Yep, well, that's correct. Again, I wish it could have told me, cannot stat device print, you must enter the device, first in the command, so that I would know what to do. But error messages, I don't know. So anyway, Parted dev SDG print, yeah, I got that. It's 2 gigabytes large, and the partition table is MS-DOS. So let's change that. Let's do a Parted/Parted/ dev SDG. What is it? Make label GPT. That's the GUID partition type or table, whatever. And that's it. So I'll just press return and let it rewrite the table. It warns me, hey, if you do this, you're going to destroy the existing table and all data on this disk is going to be lost. Are you sure you want to do this? I'm going to confirm that I typed in dev SDG. I did. And then I'm going to type in the word yes and hit return. And it says, hey, you may need to update etcf stab. Well, I don't need to do that yet. That doesn't matter to me quite yet. So I'm going to take a look at the print again, Parted dev SDG space print, and now I've got an empty drive. There are no partitions on here. It's just this GPT partition. Well, what would have happened? What if I did that on accident? Like, what if that was a mistake? Could I rescue what I just ruined? Let's try it. Parted slash dev slash SDG rescue, I think. Yeah, rescue. And then it says rescue a lost partition near start and end. Okay, so I'm going to scroll up in my terminal here and find the place where I printed the partition. Okay, well, I don't have that. I don't seem to have that in my scroll back. I don't know where it went. Did I do that in a separate terminal or something? Maybe I opened a new tab and did that or something. I'm not sure where it went. So, all right. So I don't have the start anymore, but I could take a guess and say that the first bit of data on there starts at 1,000 or 1K. Let's just start at 1K. And we know that it's 2 gigabytes in size. So I'll put 2 gigs for the end. And it says that a FAT16 primary partition was found at 1049K, which is actually what I figured it would be, all the way until 17.8 megabytes. And that's right, because I had noticed that the disk was 2 gigabytes, but that the data contained on it was only like a couple of megabytes. And it says, do you want to add this to the partition table? So I could say yes. And now if I do a Parted SDG, dev SDG print again, all of a sudden everything is sort of back where it started. Now if I go out to Dolphin and go to that drive, amazingly, yeah, all of the stuff here, this was a Linux, this was a USB slack, like a boot drive, you know, the little USB boot drive that you make when you're doing the install, that's what this was. So here's like a text file, I'll open it up, standard modes to make this kernel prompt, yeah, like the text is here, like I've rescued a partition that I just accidentally blew away. And I did that without knowing the exact start and end. I put in 1K, it should have actually been 1049, and I put in 2 gigs for the end, when actually it should have been 17.8 megabytes. So just with sort of a hazy memory of what was, I've been able to restore the partition that I just deleted, or rather overwrote. So I'm gonna actually overwrite it again. parted/dev/sdg make label GPT. All right. So once again, it's warning me that. Oh no, actually now it's warning me that I've mounted that drive. So I need to go up to my little thing. I'll safely remove that drive. I'll cancel this command and then redo it. There we go. Error, opening SDG, no medium. Oh, because I, all right, hold on. I got to remove the thing from the USB port, plug it back in. Now, because I've done that, I'm going to just confirm. Just make sure that it's SDG still. Yes, it is. Okay. So now I'm going to do the same thing. Parted. Yes. All right. So now I'm going to print SDG, parted dev SDG print. Here we are again. No partition. It's a GPT label, disk label, and the maximum or the volume, the size of this drive, which right now is empty or claims to be empty. I mean, we have just proven that we could rescue all that data with a quick restoration of the partition table, but it thinks it's empty. It's asserting that it is empty. I'm agreeing with it. Dev SDG 1940 megabytes. So if we want to make a partition that takes up this entire drive, we could do a thing like make part, and then we could say the start and the finish, so we could say 1K to 2G, again, just basically, you know, kind of, again, just kind of winging this, just saying, you'll probably need a kilobyte to sort of establish, you know, boot flat or, you know, like disk labels and things like that, and then just take it to, you know, pretty close to what we'll call 2 gigabytes. I mean, it probably won't be 2 gigabytes, but roughly. Or I could say 100% as my endpoint. I could do that as well. Let's try 1K to 100%. No, actually, it does not like that. Okay, interesting. Oh, wait, am I forgetting a flag for make part? Let's see. Make part, I think FS type is optional. Part type is required, though. That's what I'm forgetting. Okay, so let's do a man of parted. Let's look for make part. Create a new partition. Part type may be specified only with MS-DOS and DVH partition tables. Oh, okay, so that's... Oh, but it should be... one of primary logical or extended. Name is swap NTFS, riserfs, UDF, or XFS. No, sorry, I skipped a line. Name is required for GPT partition tables, and FS type is actually optional. We could do a partition type, an FS type. Okay, that's a lot of information, but I think I get it. So we're going to do parted/dev/sdg make part. So I can put a name in here, so I'll put my partition for the name. I could do a partition type, so let's just do, I guess, ext4, and then I'll do the start and the finish value. And again, start, I'm going to say 1K, and the end is 100%. Let's see if that works. It says, warning, you've requested a partition from 512 bytes to 1940 megabytes. That's sector 1 to 3,788,799. The closest location we can manage is 17.4 kilobytes to 1940 megabytes. Is that acceptable? I'm going to type in yes. And it says the resulting partition is not properly aligned for best performance. And this is another, you know, I mean, this is what I'm talking about, right? The manual labor of doing partitioning. So this is an error that's pretty common. And what it's telling you essentially is that for whatever reason, and I don't know whether this is on all drives or this drive, I don't know enough about how all of this works, but it's telling you in cryptic language that, so 34 sectors divided by 20, or rather 34 sectors, yeah, divided by 2048 sectors with the modulo does not equal zero sectors. So the sector is not aligning correctly, and it doesn't like that. So that So what does that mean? Well, it means that instead of starting your disk blindly at 1K or 0 or 17 dot, what did it try to tell me to do? 17.4 kilobytes? Instead of doing that, well, just do 2048 sectors as your start point. So 2048S, and then the endpoint will do at 100%. So the whole command that actually works for me is parted /dev/sdg /make part /mypartition/ext4 for the file type, file system type, /2048s for the starting point, /100% for the end. Just go until you can't go anymore. And then that does it without any errors. Now, if I print, I discover sort of what that all resolves to. And the resolution there is that I've got one partition on my GPT disk. Number one partition is starting at 1049 kilobytes. There's that number again. Ending at 1939 megabytes. So the size is 1938 megabytes. The file system is FAT16 and the name is my partition. Why is the partition type FAT16? I clearly did something wrong there. And that's okay. I'm not going to go back and debug that, actually. To do anything with a file system normally anyway, I just do mkfs.ext4/dev/sdg. And of course, we know that this partition is 1, so it would be sdg1. And that creates a file system on this drive. And now if I do a parted print again on SDG, I discover that there's 1049, blah, 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 file system ext4. So that's correct. It could be that the file system type in, I'm assuming that the file type partition in parted is just setting a flag rather than actually, you know, it's not making the file system. So I don't know what the point of that is. And I've never actually, and I don't think I've ever tried specifying the file system type and really to create the file system within your partition, because a partition is just imaginary. It's just a rope, right? You're just taking tape and sort of laying out on the floor, this is where I want my data to go. Well, that there's no data there yet. You've just made a little space in your room where you're going to put your data. File system, that's actually making a box. That's making the space for stuff to go. So the full sequence of events here is you do ls block, lsblk in your terminal. That gives you, and this is this is the first thing you do, right? When you think, I want to partition a disk, stop. Do lsblk. Get a readout of all the disks that are currently attached to your computer. Then attach the disk that you want to partition. Then do an lsblk again to make sure, to verify that this new disk that you've just attached to your computer has a designation that you know, right? So, because you never know, it should just get tacked on to the very end of the list. But sometimes things can get confused and, you know, you'll remove a drive and put a new one in and it'll take the designation, a surprise designation, or it'll skip a designation, whatever. So just visually confirm that that's the case. If your drive is already in your computer, you may well know the designation already. It might be the only drive in the computer. But I can't think of a case where there's only, you wouldn't be partitioning, you know, the one drive in your computer, or else you wouldn't be booted off that drive. So yeah, I would just always use lsblock to determine the drive that you really, really want to target. And you're going to know which drive it is by the size of the drive, by maybe its mount points. I think that's about it. And once you get that designation, then do parted that designation. So I'll just do SDG again. And then print to really, really make sure that you're looking at the drive that you believe you're looking at. And that gives you more information. It gives you, like, the model. This is a general U disk. I don't know what that is, but I mean, it's definitely not an ATA drive. That's good. And then once you have that, you can do you can create a partition with /parted/dev/whatever drive you're doing, make table or make label. It's literally the same thing. It's just two different terms. Make label and then whatever, either MS-DOS for sort of general, highly compatible, backwards compatible drive structure, MS-DOS, or GPT. That's the new one. You have to do a GPT if you want to drive over, what is it, 4 gigabytes or something, or 8 gigabytes, or I don't know, four terabytes. I think, yeah, maybe over 4 terabytes, something like that. It's very, very large drives. It has to use a GPT. Otherwise, you can use MS-DOS. Like I say, that'll keep it backward compatible. Once the partition table exists and you can confirm it again with the print, then you want to make the partition or a series of partitions, and that's up to you. And the way that we finally got the partition to work is we did parted/dev/sdg or whatever, make part, mkpart, and then a partition name like my partition or my first partition or my boot partition, whatever, Slackware, whatever. And then a file system type optional, that didn't really seem to work for me. And then the start and the end of that partition. So if you've got a 4 gigabyte drive and you want 2 partitions of 2 gigs, then you would do something like 2048 sectors to 2 gigs. And then you would go from like the end point of that partition to the end point of the drive. So maybe like 2 gig to 100%. That would probably work. And you'll get errors along the way, possibly about like alignment and sector size and things like that. And you can adjust based on the feedback. It's not great feedback, but it typically throws numbers at you that you can then base your next guess on. And then once you're done with parted, after you've made all your partitions, then you're done with parted, and then you can move on to the next step, which is to actually put a file system into those partitions. And they don't have to be the same file system. You can do ext4 on partition 1, and then butterfs on the next one, or jfs on partition 2, or xfs, or whatever you think is necessary. You can do an ext4 on one partition, and then like a what's that one, exfat for like, you know, broad compatibility. It is now time for a coffee break. Oh, and there are a lot more p's than I realized. I mean, to say nothing of the fact that I've just spent like 20 minutes on parted when I should have spent like 2 minutes on parted. That's a lot more than I realized. We're not going to get through all the P's in this episode. That's not a problem. We'll have coffee, we'll relax, and we'll get through what we get through. Starting now, get coffee, relax. And I'm back with coffee. This is the coffee I was talking about last time. It's called Sacred Grounds. That's very sort of, that's a bigger name than I thought it would have. But that's what it's called. Sacred Grounds is the brand, I guess. And then Mahia is the, I guess, the variety or the roast. M-A-H-I-A, Mahia. And it is legitimately one of the best coffees I've had in a long time. And I know I do tend to have high praise for many of the coffees that I try, but this one is special. That was, it's been really good. I just opened it like last week, I think, right? Right before the show, essentially, like a day before the show, maybe. I think actually the evening before I recorded last week's episode, and, or was it 2 weeks? Either way, I'm almost out. It has been so good, and I'm really going to have to make a stop at that cafe just to get more coffee next time I'm out that way. It's just got that nice full body to it, and then that just that hint of a dark roast. Just a hint. It's just like, oh, by the way, forgot to tell you, there were a couple of really darkly roasted beans in here. Just a couple. We consolidated them for you. So yeah, absolutely a fan of this coffee. Highly recommended should you ever come across this exact coffee, and it has to be this one. And I can only imagine that there must surely be other coffee companies out there called Sacred Grounds. That just sounds too, that's a pretty good pun, you know? And Mahia, M-A-H. IA, and or it could be Mahia. I don't know. And if I'm a kind of going with the concept that maybe it's a Maori word, in which case it would be Mahia, I think. Although there's no macron over the A, so yeah, maybe not. Okay. Anyway, we should keep going with the applications here, the libraries, because I actually really wanted to get to Pipewire. That's kind of the star of today's show, which is going to be inconvenient when I don't get down to Pipewire. So let's see if we can get to Pipewire today. Parted, we did. PC Audio Lib. PC Audio Lib is a portable C audio library that provides access to ALSA, Pulse Audio, and also eSpeak-ng, which is where the library comes from, that is provided by eSpeak-ng. eSpeak-ng, of course, is eSpeak Next Generation or New Generation, whatever NG actually stands for, and it is the text-to-speech application, one of the text-to-speak applications provided on Linux. PC Audio Lib, like I say, I mean, it's a C library. It lets you talk to the audio stack through either ALSA, directly to Pulse, OSS. That's it. Okay, let's talk next about PCRE. That's a Perl compatible regular expression library. I think it was just two episodes ago, I think. I was talking about regex and how there were different expressions of regular expressions. There's not really a set sort of a law about how regular expressions are written, but the PCRE, or rather the Perl method of regular expression is pretty darned close to being a standard. I mean, it's kind of a it's pretty well known. I mean, Perl for a while was kind of the scripting language of open source. I mean, it was a big deal. I keep thinking to myself, I think of it as essentially as Bash plus plus. That's how it feels to me when I'm writing Perl. I'm very, very fond of Perl, I have found. You can hear all about my thoughts on Perl back in episode 429, 431. And so Perl regular expression kind of got, relatively well known. I'm not saying it's the only well-known one. I'm just saying that's one of them. It's a big deal. PCRE is Perl compatible regular expressions using essentially the syntax and semantics as those found in Perl 5. But this isn't for Perl. PCRE library is a C library. So it's essentially I was going to say backporting, but I mean it's not backporting, but it's enabling you in C to use regular expressions that you would have become familiar with or used to while using Perl. So that's quite nice. This is the kind of translation layer almost that not necessarily for regular expressions really, but I mean just for anything. It's great that that sort of thing exists. I mean I love that kind of thing where you just develop a preference. You can think of it as in Emacs. There's Vial mode, which is you can use Emacs but with Vi or Vim key bindings. Sounds like a crazy idea. But that's a perfect expression of the same thing, Perl and C. Like it's not that one is right or one is wrong. It's not that one's better than the other. It's just literally you happen to prefer that way of doing it, or you just got used to doing it that way. I mean, that's kind of at the point at where I am with Emacs, to be honest. It isn't necessarily that I necessarily like have nostalgia for Emacs or that I feel particularly fond of Emacs. It's just that when I started using Emacs, I found that it really worked for me, and it's really hard to switch away from Emacs. I mean, because there are just certain things in Emacs that are just so nice, so efficient, and I can't give that up. So I feel like that's the same kind of thing. If you knew Perl regular expressions, then why give that up just because you happen to be writing C today? And I wish that was just for a lot more stuff, just a lot more stuff on computing, where you have these little almost modular preferences down to down to the keystroke, or down to the asterisk, and you get to take that with you into whatever else you want to take it to. I don't know how that would even be implemented. I mean, that just seems mind-blowingly modular, maybe, you know? Like, you just pick and choose, and how would you even assemble it? Like, I don't even know. But I think when you see it, it sure does feel good. You know, it's just like, yeah, that's great. I've got exactly what I needed this over in this new application over here. Perfect. And it's nice. So, and I think ideally computers would be that all over the place, but it's just not there yet. I mean, I don't think we're anywhere near that. That's just such an advanced concept to have a computer actually just fulfill all of your preferences. That's just stunning to even conceive of. Okay, so PCRE, PCRE2, those are there. Those are libraries. Let's talk about Phonon. Phonon, very cool. I met a person who was working on Phonon a long time ago. And Phonon is a multimedia API provided by Qt, and it is the standard abstraction layer, this is important, for handling multimedia streams within KDE. So I don't know if I would call it, I mean, that's just the text from the file on the repo. I don't know if I'd call it a framework for Qt. I guess it's becoming a framework for Qt, but it's not, I don't think it's 100% there yet. Maybe it is. But the Phonon actually was developed exclusively or specifically for KDE back in 2004, I think. So they come up with this sort of concept of, okay, well, we need a way to make sound play on our desktop, on our new Plasma desktop. How are we going to do that? And the idea is, like, on some, it's an abstraction layer. So on some operating systems, for instance, I'll talk about Mac, even though that's not fair because I haven't used a Mac in over 10 years at this point. But on a Mac, I feel relatively sure that you could not, for instance, decide that you didn't want to use QuickTime as your media handler anymore. There's some exceptions to that, like a Blackmagic card or something like that, where you're technically using something else for the media playback. But generally speaking, and that's hardware anyway, so generally speaking, you couldn't just say, well, you know what, QuickTime seems really limited to me. I think I'd rather my desktop just use VLC. And now you can install VLC on macOS. You can set it as your default media player. But when you record audio into an application that was written for macOS, you can't tell it, don't use the QuickTime sort of engine to record this audio. Use VLC instead. It's going to record your data, your audio, through QuickTime, because that's how the system is built. Again, you can play it back through QuickTime, although actually you may not be able to. Like, if you're in Logic Pro and you decide, you know, I'd really rather play this through VLC. Okay, well, bounce, because that's not going to happen. You're going to play it through QuickTime. If you render it or bounce it, whatever, freeze it. No, not freeze, bounce. If you bounce it, then yes, you can play it in VLC, but you cannot just decide that your system is now going to use VLC. On Linux, you can do that. You can say, today I would rather use GStreamer and not VLC. Or you could say, I'd rather use VLC and not GStreamer. And I think there are other options as well. I haven't looked lately. And that's what Phonon does. Phonon essentially sets up in this case, I feel like I'm being vague, but it sets up a framework and it says, there are audio devices and there is a file that wants to be played. How do I get those two things to hook up? And Phonon doesn't do it, but Phonon provides a place, a meeting place for those devices, or a bridge, I guess, for those two devices. And that bridge, you have to make it out of something. It has to be either GStreamer or VLC or whatever other backends they are. Xine, I think, X-I-N-E, that's one of them. You can slot anything in there into the Phonon container, and then the file that the user wants to play and their speakers that they've just plugged into their computers, now those two things can happen. So this is different from saying, like, going into settings and saying, oh, I want my default media player to be VLC. Oh, I want my default, where is that anyway? Default applications. If you go to settings and go to default applications, there's web browser, file manager, email. Oh, so there's not even a option for media players. Interesting. Okay, I didn't realize that. But this is different than saying, oh, I want my, you know, when I click on a movie, I want it to open up in Dragon, or when I click on a movie, I want it to open up in VLC. This is really actually saying, when you open up Dragon, how do you want that video to be played in Dragon? Do you want to do that through the VLC libraries or through the GStreamer library? What are you using to make that happen? And Phonon is behind all of that. I don't know if that makes sense 100%. A little bit hard to picture. I mean, it's honestly a little bit hard to picture for me as well. And I've programmed stuff with VLC libraries before. So it is a little bit hard to imagine like this thing that doesn't do the actual work, but hooks into something that does. It's kind of weird. But anyway, that's what Phonon does. They are working on or have worked on de-KDE-ifying it and making it general purpose use for Qt, which I could imagine would be really, really useful. They may have already done it. I'm not sure. But if not, they are, I see wiki posts on Qt.io and wiki posts on userbase.kde.org or something like that, where they are talking about the work that needs to be done to get it just in general Qt. But for now, or at least as of this Slackware release, it was still a work in progress, as I understand it. The next package is Phonon Backend GStreamer. You can guess what that is from the name. It's the GStreamer backend for Phonon. So that's the thing that lets Phonon use GStreamer. I don't know why GStreamer has a different package than, say, VLC. I'm not really sure. Maybe Slackware isn't using the VLC libraries for that. I mean, that would kind of make sense, right? Because VLC doesn't actually come with the OS. So maybe it's just using GStreamer. I'm not sure. But with Phonon, you could install VLC and then select VLC as your backend. Okay, next up is Pilot Link. We're very close to Pipewire right now. Pilot Link, it's a library for communicating with Palm OS devices. I think I've mentioned this before. Don't exactly know. Oh, because, you know why? Because we were talking about KPilot. That's why I mentioned this before. So in whatever episode we were talking about KPilot in, would have been a while ago now, I said that long, long ago, and you can search this in your favorite search engine if you want, but long ago, there were these devices called Palm Pilots. Palm Pilot, that's the other. Palm Pilot is what it was called. And then from Palm Pilot, I think the founder of Palm, I think, left the company, but then started his own company called Handspring. And Handspring was a device exactly like the Palm Pilot, except, you know, slightly different. They came out with the Visor, V-I-S-O-R. And these were just little handheld, like a cell phone, about the size of a cell phone. And you could take notes or load up text files on them. I think probably a lot of systems at the time had applications where you would, you know, you'd get to work in the morning and you would put your Palm Pilot on your little dock and then you'd load all of your email onto it to read, you know, and then you'd take your Palm Pilot and like go to lunch, but you'd be reading your Palm Pilot with all your emails on it or something like that. There was some kind of synchronization. Maybe it wasn't emails, but it was like certainly like calendar, you know, daily agenda, that sort of thing. People were using it for that kind of activity. I happened to have a Handspring Visor by a very chance. Like it was a weird, like I got one literally for free back when I was in university, and it was great. I mean, it wasn't a perfect device by any means, but when you have to commute to university an hour on a subway every morning and an hour back, then having a Palm Pilot where you could read, I got so much reading done on those things. And I think that was probably mostly what I used it for. I don't remember like writing on it often. You could write. They had a little stylus and it had a special alphabet of simplified glyphs that, you know, it was like English, but it was like hyper simplified. Like an A was just a sort of a pointy, just the pointy part of the A. You didn't have to put the crossbar because that would have been too, you know, that would have been another stroke, right? So everything was kind of like one motion of your little stylus. Pretty quick to learn, really. And then that it would convert it would convert your stylus movement into a typed letter. So it was neat. It was probably, I think, definitely ahead of its time, meaning that its ideas, I think its ideas outpaced its capabilities. But it was really popular for a while. I think this was like Palm Pilot, and then the next stop on the hype train was probably BlackBerry, I think. And then from BlackBerry, then it was just now. Like cell phones, you know, like that was just, I mean, I guess BlackBerry was a cell phone, but I think early BlackBerries might have been, I don't know, different. Probably were. A lot of early implementations of things were different than the current ones. Okay, so that's Pilot Link. If you want to link up your Palm Pilot device with your modern Linux system, you can. Palm Link will be used by KPilot. KPilot is, of course, the application that we've already discussed in a previous episode. Let's talk about Pipewire. This is why this was kind of the appeal for me. This episode was going to be about Pipewire, and it ended up being about Parted instead. It can also be about Pipewire because, as it turns out, there's not that much to say about Pipewire. Pipewire is the modern re-implementation or reinvention to replace Pulse Audio. If you hate Pulse, you're going to possibly hate Pipewire. But Pipewire, in my opinion, it's great. I mean, it's amazing. I mean, I never had a problem with Pulse either, to be honest. In fact, I quite appreciated what Pulse was doing for me. I've said before, I'll say it really quickly again, there used to be a time in Linux when you would be writing music with Jack open and your digital audio workstation open, and you'd want to go to a website and audition a sound that you think you're going to download, but you want to hear it first because, I mean, why not? Couldn't do it. You'd have to stop Jack. You have to switch your audio back over to ALSA or something weird like that, or something, or turn off Jack so that you could then hear the web browser through ALSA. Yeah, that was what it was, because the web browser couldn't talk to Jack. And so you just didn't get to, you know, like that was an experience that you had on Linux that no one else in the world was having. There was also already enough criticism about doing multimedia on Linux without the grim reality that, oh, by the way, if you're doing something in an audio application, a professional level audio application, you won't be able to do anything with sound anywhere else on your system. Not a great feeling. Yeah, there are some Jack and ALSA bridges that you could probably set up and try to get around that. But I mean, you just figured out how to use Jack. Let's just slow down. Okay, so that was, Pulse alleviated that problem. Like, it got rid of that problem, which was amazing. That was just amazing. Now, Pipewire goes a couple of steps further. Pipewire is doing what Pulse does. It's got everything that Pulse has, as of, I want to say, Fedora 34. And then since then, there's been something like 40 releases, and they've added effects, audio filters, and audio effects. They've added, I think, most importantly, probably echo cancellation. That's not like echo cancellation for filtering thing. That's where you are looping back sound in your own system, but you don't want to hear the sound that you have looped back. You need to exclude pipelines or pipe wires, as you might think of them, from getting essentially feedback, and that's been added. There has been video support, and re-implementation of Jack. So Pipewire can do, I think, most of what Jack can do. I haven't tested it fully yet, and my main question is about MIDI, and I'm not sure where that fits into all of this. I don't think it does, which is fine. I've always just used the ALSA sequencer anyway, so I don't think that should be a domain of Pipewire. But really, really significantly is that Pipewire doesn't just do audio. It can also do video. It can do video streams, which is important if you're, for instance, trying to work in an Ardour project or a Qtractor project, and you're trying to sync up your like maybe the sound effects that you're designing for your little short film or something. You want to do that while watching the movie so that you can get things in sequence. this is the kind of thing that Pipewire could potentially eventually help you do. And there's a lot more. I mean, like I said, there's literally been something like 40 releases since it sort of debuted in round about Fedora 34. I think Fedora 34 is the time that Fedora switched over to Pipewire, I think, or at least it's shipped with Pipewire. So that was kind of a big deal. And Fedora is on 39 now. So, and you know, Fedora has short release cycles. So saying that there's been 40 releases means that it's quite actively developed right now. And yeah, so Pipewire is doing cameras, it's doing videos, it's doing audio. It's ideally just sending sound all over the place. And that's exactly what I want on my Linux system. I really do, badly. And I've wanted it for such a long time. I have set up so many loopbacks and null devices or dummy devices where you then send your sound to the dummy device and then you load a module into Pulse. But if Pulse has been launched with disabling module loading, then you have to fix that. You load a module to echo for echo cancellation, and then maybe if you're lucky, the thing that you're trying to send a sound to actually recognizes it. It's such a painful process. And with Pipewire, it has been so much better. Like, it just has. And it's not that everyone everywhere always needs to be able to do weird sound routing, but I think for the people who, for whatever reason, want to, I think that should be really easy on Linux. I mean, that's such a Linuxy thing to do, right? Just to say, oh yeah, I've got a sound over here. I've got an application over here that will accept sound. Let's just hook those two things together. I mean, something as simple as like a soundboard in a video chat, like that should be so easy on Linux. I mean, you can just almost picture the application in your head. It would look a lot like Jack, but maybe prettier because it's 2024. And you could just draw a line from like, here's my media player. I'll draw a line. I'll drag a little noodle from this node to that node. And now suddenly the inputs and outputs are lining up. I don't understand why that's not easier to do. And I'll go one further and say, what if you have devices like a phone and you decide that, you know, you're watching a really great video online and you decide, well, I'm going to pick up my phone. I'm going to go into the kitchen to make myself a cup of coffee. Well, could I just crank up the speakers and hope I can still hear it over the kettle boiling? Or could I instead just flick my sound device over to my mobile device and suddenly have that video or that sound or whatever, or both, playing on my mobile device that I'm going to now take into the next room? And it should be that easy. I mean, it should be that easy. And it isn't. And it hasn't been. And I don't know that it's that easy on any device. And I know you can do fancy things like sign into Firefox and sync Firefox between your phone and your desktop. And then you could sign into like the whatever, you know, YouTube or whatever you're watching the video on, maybe. And then, I don't know, maybe there's some capability there. I don't know. I bet you could do it with Chromecast. I don't really know anything about that either, but I'm imagining somewhere someone has figured this stuff out. I know that, for instance, Apple has, what is it, AirPlay, which actually Pipewire, interestingly, supports. AirPlay support and multiple sample rates. So you can use AirPlay, whatever that is. That's the speakers, right? The remote speakers throughout your house. So you can use that with Pipewire. So you just send music to where, you know, and that's the kind of thing that should be easy on Linux. That should not be something that's difficult. That should be so, so easy. And it's just not. And like I say, I don't know that it's easy anywhere. I mean, I imagine sending audio to an AirPlay device from a macOS device is probably easy. You probably select from a drop-down menu, send this sound to AirPlay. There, done. That's great. That's great for them. That's not my only use case, though. I mean, yes, I would love remote speakers that can just be targets for my audio or my video or whatever. But I want it even more agile than that. I want to be able to flick audio from my laptop to my desktop to my mobile device. I want to be able to send it between applications. I just want there to be no bounds. And I don't feel like there should be bounds. And of course, I'm saying this all just as if though, well, it should be so easy. And yes, it probably should be easy, but it's not. These are computers, and it, you know, someone's got to make this science fiction in my head happen. And that's really what makes me so excited about Pipewire, is because it seems to me that Vim Taman is, that's the creator of Pipewire, it seems to me like Vim Taman is making it happen. And that's really exciting. I mean, the idea that audio and video are finally being synchronized by the same demon, that's brilliant. Because, I mean, before you needed Jack, and then you needed XJade. Or XJDO, XJADEO. You had to kind of hook those two together. And then, so then your video player, XJDO, is essentially tethered to your Jack playhead. And then you start your audio application, which is also now tethered to the Jack playhead. And then that's what's synchronizing them. It works. It works quite well. I've used it. It's great. But it's multiple steps. Not a whole lot of people know about XJDO. Not even really sure nowadays whether it's being maintained all that much. So Pipewire, to just handle all of that, that's great. That would be amazing. So if you haven't tried Pipewire, you can try Pipewire, and you may not see a difference right away. I mean, ideally, you won't see a difference right away. But if you become root on your Slackware system, and then look in /usr/sbin for pipewire-enable.sh. That's a script by Patrick Volkerding. And it'll enable the Pipewire daemon, and it'll make whatever adjustment it has to make to Pulse. I still can't quite figure out the relationship between Pipewire and Pulse, but right now, essentially what happens, and so Pipewire enable .sh, that's in sbin, USR sbin, Pipewire-enable.sh. You run that, it's super quick. I mean, it's just a configuration file change. You run that, and then I think, do you have to log out and log back in, maybe? I'm not sure. But then do PACTL, that's Pulse Audio Control, PACTL space info. And, you must not be root to do PACTL info. You have to be a normal user. And for that, it says the server name is Pulse Audio, but then in parentheses, it says on Pipewire 0.3.44 in this case, which I'm sure is a very outdated Pipewire. I should probably look into updating that. So you're still, yes, you're using the Pulse Audio daemon, but it's the one from Pipewire-Pulse. So it's not really Pulse. Once you do that, you switch over to Pipewire. Now on slackbuilds.org, there's a package called Wire Plumber, and if you install Wire Plumber, you'll find in usr/sbin/wireplumber-enable.sh. This has a couple of different tools to control your sound through your terminal to get some diagnostics about your sound system and so on. So it's kind of nice. I mean, it's not necessary. You don't have to use it, but you can. You can use Pipewire without this. But if you have Wire Plumber installed, you can get quite a lot of information about what's happening on your systems, specifically with WPCTL, Wire Plumber Control Status, I think is what it's command pipe most, yeah. So WPCTL space status, and it tells you all of the different clients that are sort of running on your computer, which is really quite, I mean, quite informative. Like things that you don't maybe think of as audio clients, it'll tell you about, which is kind of nice. So there's obviously Wire Plumber, there's KMix, there's Speech Dispatcher, there's Firefox right now running on my system. There's Elisa, that's the music player. I just have that idling in, or it's launched. It's in the system tray. It doesn't really go away. Q-Pulse, don't know what that is. Plasma PA, Pulse Audio, I guess. Audacity, also plugin for Audacity, and so on. So lots of different applications, and then it sees the devices as well. There's the CH321, the Handy Recorder Stereo Mix, HD Pro Webcam, the Starship Matisse HD Audio Controller, that's the sound card on this thing, and so on. So you get all kinds of diagnostics. You get to see what streams are active, what's capturing, what's playing, just everything you could want about all of that. Devices and what driver has seen the device and is making it useful or usable rather. Yeah, it's really quite amazing. Wire Plumber, and then specifically WPCTL. But I mean, Wire Plumber is from slackbuilds.org. It's not officially part of this discussion. Pipewire itself, I've just told you several features that it's going to introduce and that it has introduced. It's just going that much above and beyond where Pulse Audio left off. And that's just great because, yeah, I mean, we want these things to get better and better and better. You don't really, it's not all that much fun to be using Linux and then to feel like you're giving up a bunch of features because you're using Linux. That's not the desired experience. Like, Linux is supposed to be the place you go for the features. And it oftentimes is, but sometimes you start to feel like the features are only meant for like the developers. And if that's not what makes you happy with your computer, then you want some of those features as well. And Pipewire truly, truly, I mean, it's an amazing little engine that's making a bunch of cool things for users become more and more possible. I was going to say popular. So for the users out there, myself included, one of the coolest things I think I've seen in a long time is the Helvum, H-E-L-V-U-M, Helvum application. It's a patch bay for Pipewire. This is a lot like Patchage, is what the application used to be called. Is called P-A-T-C-H. A-G-E, Patchage, Patchage. Patchage was, it is, I keep saying was because I used to use it more than I do now. So to me, it's like something that I used to do, but it's actually something current. It's been updated. Like it's an active project. I don't mean to make it sound like it's not important. It is important. It's a really great application. I really, really like it. And it has these little boxes, and the boxes represent different sound devices, whether it's, again, your system sound, your sound card, or a software synthesizer that's generating sound, and so on. Anything that shows up in Jack, you can view in Patchage. It's an alternate view to Jack, or maybe it's your only view if you're running Jack from the terminal, which is what I used to do. I would just, but I keep saying everything is in the past tense. I guess I'm doing this because Pipewire has truly shaken everything up for me. So I'm kind of finding my new workflow now. But what I was doing with Jack is that I would launch Jack from a terminal, and that would just start the daemon. And then I would run Patchage, and that would show me everything available within, you know, to Jack. And then I'd start my audio applications or my software synthesizer, and they would pop up there as little boxes. And then I would string, you draw little noodles, little wires, from one box to another box to demonstrate, I want this software, this synthesizer, or rather this keyboard, this physical keyboard on my piano keyboard on my desk. I want that to send its input over to this synthesizer. When that synthesizer receives a signal, I want it to put output sound over to this application. And everything coming out of this application, I want to hear on my computer system. And you could change that up. You could detach a piano keyboard to another synthesizer. You could hook up two synthesizers or a synthesizer and a sequencer, and send that over to your application or just straight to your sound output. If you don't even have to be running a digital audio workstation, you can just play synths and maybe run a sequencer or something, or not. You can just literally just play synths. So that was Patchage, and that was great. Well, Helvum is that, except for Pipewire. And I haven't given it a run for its money yet, so I don't want to say that it's like replaced anything yet, because I don't know that it has. But if I'm speaking Greek to you, and you're not Greek, when I'm talking about like synths and sequencers and things like that, then Helvum might be perfect for you, because what, you know, if you're not running any synths and things like that, and you just want to make sure that the sound from Firefox gets piped over to, your OBS, studio recorder, your broadcaster, you can do that. And all you have to do is connect the little outputs to the inputs. And it's that easy. Like you can just route system all around, route sound all around on your system. You know, anything almost goes to anything else. It's just kind of amazing. And yeah, you should take a look at it. It's on FlatHub, org.pipewire.helvum, capital H, Helvum. It's a beautiful application. Like really, like if you're one of those people, you know, a quote unquote visual thinker or whatever, like this is the application that you want. I guess it could maybe be prettier. Maybe the boxes could be like icons or something. I don't know. But I mean, to me, like it's amazing. And there are a couple of them out there like that. There's also QPW, like cute, PW Pipewire graph, QPW graph. This is by the same guy who does Q-Tractor. So it's really nice as well. It does essentially the same thing. It's got the inputs and the outputs. It's got a slightly different visual look to it. So one of those two, Helvum or QPW graph, is just transformative. I mean, it absolutely makes interacting with your sound just completely different. And in a way, I feel like it fulfills a lot of kind of the expectations. I wouldn't say it fulfills the promises of Pulse Audio, because I don't think Pulse Audio really knew yet to promise this kind of thing. Or maybe they did, but they just never got around to it. I'm not sure. I don't remember ever hearing sort of like, I don't remember ever like sort of hearing promises about this kind of functionality. But I think once people saw what Pulse could do, I think ideas started happening. It was just like, hey, why don't we go take this farther? And Pipewire is doing that. So Pipewire is amazing. I hesitate to say you have to check it out, because quite honestly, you may not have to check it out. Maybe it wouldn't make that much of a difference for you. But if you have ever found yourself going into the terminal and loading Pulse Audio modules manually, or adding dummy sound devices manually, or trying to route sound with PA, CTL, stops and statuses and restarts and things like that, just stop. Do not bother. Take my word for it. It's not worth it. It is time to switch over to Pipewire. And again, user sbin pipewire-enable.sh. Patrick Volkerding's figured it all out for you. Just run that, and then optionally go to slackbuilds.org and install Wire Plumber, and again, user sbin wireplumber-enable.sh, and you're good to go. Reboot, just always reboot. I will say one caveat to all of this has been I've got a Zoom recorder hooked up to my computer for the recording of my voice, and ever since switching over to Pipewire, I can't get the sample rate of my Zoom recorder to agree with the sample rate of Audacity, and I'm not sure why. I've got Audacity set to 44.1. I've got my Zoom set to 44.1. I don't know where the translation error is happening. I don't know if it's in the Zoom recorder, don't know if it's in Audacity, don't know if it's in Pipewire, but it has been since changing to Pipewire, there has been a mismatch between those two devices. And in fact, I've recorded this episode on a headset, a USB headset that I have, because the Zoom recorder is just not working right now. I mean, it is working, but it records me at a sample rate that is incorrect for my recorder. So that's been weird, and I'm not sure what's going on there. I have only tried it on Slackware though, so it could be something, could be a configuration change that I've made long ago to my sound system that has now finally come around to not being compatible with the rest of the configuration. So further testing is required for that. I'm also at the point where, I've kind of been between my, and I kind of think, does it make sense to have my portable audio recorder tethered permanently to my computer? Because now I'm not using it. So I've been thinking about getting a microphone anyway. So this might be the thing to inspire me to actually save up the money and get the microphone and so on. We'll see. Either way, though, further testing is required, because I do want to know what the problem is. Whether or not I ever resolve it is another question. So anyway, and supposedly Pipewire has better Bluetooth support, but I don't have data on why that would be true. So I'm not so sure about that. I mean, like, when they say better Bluetooth, and I don't even know who they is. This is something I just heard online. I didn't hear in like an interview or anything, but I've heard people say, oh, Bluetooth will work better with Pipewire. I have not tried that yet. I keep forgetting to try it, but I feel like Bluetooth is going to fail. Like if it's a connection error, then it's going to fail either way, I would think. I wouldn't think Pipewire would be able to fix that. So I think maybe it depends on what the error is, because surely the ability to send sound to a Bluetooth, surely the error would be happening in the driver, not the sound server. I don't know. It's, again, lots of stuff to test. Pipewire is really cool. Like I say, if you've been modifying your Pulse Audio configuration, try Pipewire instead. You might be glad that you did. Okay, that's really the most exciting thing about this episode for me. So with that, I think it's okay to call this episode done. And next time we'll start with PolKit, policy kit. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next time.